I mean, it was like really, it was devastating. I mean, it was new. It was people frantically messaging me from all over saying, "Yeah, Euler's being actively attacked right now," and yeah, it was harrowing, really, really harrowing experience. Everybody, all the victims in the protocol had lost like everything at that point, and they were feeling, yeah, beside themselves. The whole team was absolutely distraught. You know, we always took security really, really seriously. Like we felt that we'd gone above and beyond in every dimension we could, and it was a real shock.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. But first, I'd like to thank the amazing sponsors of this podcast. Managing on-chain payroll, vesting plans, and airdrops with traditional solutions can quickly become time-consuming and lead to misaligned incentives. Sabder is a battle-tested, free-to-use, open-source solution for token distribution. It's available on Ethereum and nearly every EVM chain out there. And the core protocol is decentralized and permissionless. Organizations like Shapeshift, Maple Finance, and TokenSite have used Sabder to manage vesting plans and grants with hundreds of different recipients. Treasury managers are head over heels for Sabder thanks to the peace of mind and great user experience. Learn how Sabder can boost your organization and book a demo to get started at sabder.com. Buckle up, because Proof of Podcast has something special for you. Introducing Remedy, the ultimate Web3 cybersecurity platform custom built to propel you to the forefront of the Web3 revolution. Jam-packed with the very best in emerging tech, Remedy empowers blockchains, Web3 projects, and security researchers with innovative tools and services, like Glider, a code query engine that lets you hunt vulnerabilities at the blockchain scale. How? By letting you query specific code in every smart contract on every integrated EVM blockchain within seconds. And also an easy-to-onboard bug bounty hosting service backed by elite triaging and zero-knowledge tech that makes duplicates report a thing of the past. So what are you waiting for? Sign up today at r.xyz and leverage the power of Remedy to supercharge the complete security lifecycle of Web3 projects. For those who don't know you and what you do, you are the CEO of Euler, one of the soon-to-be biggest protocols in DeFi. Do you mind explaining shortly your background, how you got here, and what's Euler?
Of course, yeah. Well, firstly, thanks for having me on. Yeah, where did I got started in DeFi back in 2020. That's when I started Euler with my co-founder, Doug. Back then, or just before then, I used to be a research scientist at Oxford University. I used to do a lot of research on evolutionary game theory, so mainly building, yeah, quite different to the day job today, I suppose, in some ways, but in other ways really, really quite similar. But yeah, I was mostly doing research in building models of populations and how populations change through time, especially when there's some strategic component involved. So you have, like, you know, different actors, you kind of view them, these different actors in the populations playing different games, like they're trying to cooperate or compete with one another to maximize their sort of reproductive output. So those are the kind of research problems I was tackling, studying populations of biological entities like cancer cells in amongst healthy cells, and you know, mutant bacteria that are antibiotic resistant in populations of wild type bacteria and invasive hornets and all these weird sort of wonderful systems of populations and things. And yeah, I'd been interested in crypto for a few years going back before that, and that's really how I ended up falling down the rabbit hole full time with Euler. It really came together during, or just before DeFi summer, to be honest. I was doing hackathons in my spare time. The pandemic was in full swing, and so I'd been sort of not furloughed, but there wasn't necessarily a lot of work to do in the day job. So I had a bit of extra time on my hands to think about problems that interested me. And one of those was like this sort of emerging system of DeFi, decentralized finance, that really sort of captured my imagination, especially a protocol called Compound Finance, which is, you know, another lending protocol I was really impressed with how that sort of came together, and it all started to click for me, like how DeFi might work and become a really big, fully fledged financial system of its own when I saw that. And so I started hacking around at that time with interest rate models and how to maybe set interest rates in a decentralized way. And suddenly I found myself, winning a hackathon with Doug. And shortly after, that's how we started Euler full time. We had offers from investors to take the project full time and start to build a software development company to bring it all together. So yeah, that's how I got started.
So that transition sounds like it was pretty full on. You went from one day being research scientist to quitting your job and doing all of it full time. Was that what happened?
Yeah, more or less. I mean, it was quite a change in direction for sure. I mean, I just had my first child as well. My daughter was born earlier that year. And that actually, weirdly, one of the reasons I did the hackathon was I started doing these hackathons was because I thought, oh, it's quite an easy way to win a bit of money. And I thought it would pay for a cot, pay for some all the things that babies need. They cost a lot of money, so that's partly why I started doing them in my spare time. So one of the first hackathons I did, I started to try to create the sort of NFT trading type game. I wanted to build something like that initially, I was one of those side projects you start but never really get to finish. And so some of the people I was participating in the hackathon with, we're talking more about DeFi and that emerging system and things like Uniswap and Yearn and Compound. And that suddenly it all started to click. And I had this offer to leave my job. And it was in the middle of the pandemic when the day job just wasn't going as it would normally go. All the lab scientists that I used to work with, all the collaborators and things were kind of furloughed. And so it was just an opportunity of a lifetime, as they say.
Yeah, very cool. Before you go more into Euler, I got really curious about the research work you were doing. So it was like a game theory research in the context of like biological entities like cells and stuff. Mm-hmm. And from that, would you say that cells are game theoretically like smart? Because you can say that humans are probably not very game theoretically smart because we're not that rational, but how do cells do they better than us?
I suppose, yeah. I mean, natural selection is this ruthless optimizer. Random variations emerge spontaneously through mutation, and then they can be inherited, right? And so natural selection favors those things, those rare variants that do better than the competition. And that happens at all sorts of scales in biological populations, from genes within a genome. Genes compete with one another to replicate ahead of other genes. And then the genomes themselves, compete. You have things like viruses, which are kind of just collections of genes, I suppose, that have this very loose like assemblage around them. And then cells are competing all the time, but then you get cells that emerge that have a tendency to sort of stick together, I suppose. And that leads to multicellular organisms, which compete with multicellular organisms. And you have this ruthless process happening. Like natural selection doesn't just happen at one level. It happens at multiple levels of organization in biology. And at each level, every natural selection is always favoring things that are kind of ruthlessly optimized to procreate and to pass on their inherited characteristics to the next generation. And I would say that some of the most highly optimized things are the things that replicate on very short timescales and that actually don't have any sort of sentient awareness of themselves or anything. So things like viruses and bacteria, natural selection is arguably the strongest there because the turnover times are very quick. You get billions and billions and billions of entities competing. And so the competition is really, really fierce. Even very small, I used to work in these labs with bacteria, and even, just small mutations, which give you a, 0.0001% better chance of doing better compared to the cells around you will very quickly take over a population.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it's cool. You can with bacteria, you can do these experiments where you watch natural selection and evolution really play out in a matter of days or weeks.
That's wild. Do you think you got some takeaways from that research or that area of study that you use while doing Euler?
There's quite a few different sort of angles here. There's like a practical one. When you work as an evolutionary theorist, you work in these kind of environments, you have to be a bit of a jack of all trades. So you have to be good at tinkering, experimenting, and learning new things. So on a practical side, you have to be, firstly, a lot of evolutionary theory is sort of maths. So you have to be quite good at maths. You have to know a bit of game theory. You have to know a bunch of maths called dynamical systems, you know, how things change over time. Which is more like, you know, closely aligned with like physics and mechanistic models of how things change. But oftentimes the math gets really sort of hairy quite quickly, because when you have strategies competing against strategies, it's like that you get these sort of non-linear feedback loops. It turns out like in physics, you can often just solve an equation and go, yeah, I know that this particle will be there in an hour's time, given that these forces act on it. It's not the same in biological populations. The forces like act on you and you act back on the forces, and then you get these feedback loops. It gets really hard to predict. So you end up oftentimes like simulating things. So you have to learn a lot of computer science and build, you know, models of populations and like how things change in silico, I suppose, in these computer simulation. So you get that side, and then of course you need the biological knowledge as well, like how things work at a lower level. Like you need to know a little bit of chemistry at times. It really you end up being this jack of all trades, and that ends up being really useful, I think, in the industry that I work in now. And just being a co-founder and a founder generally, it's useful to be able to talk to people at lots of different levels and know a little bit about lots of things, I think, is really useful.
Yeah. How did the idea for Euler specific came about? Because it seems like it was a pretty full-on jump from you.
So the actual, like, I suppose, yeah, the nexus of the idea was this. I was going back to all these different, like, branches of, like, sciences and things you end up stumbling upon. There was somebody that I used to work with that used to work on a branch of maths called control theory. Which was like, when you've got this system changing through time, like can you modify the environment to kind of force a system into a certain state? And the simplest example of this, I guess, is like in your home, you have a thermostat and you want to like control the temperature in the house. And so that's like the thing you're trying to control, and the mechanisms you have to control it to kind of increase or decrease the power output to the you know, your radiators or your heating system or whatever. And so you have this constant process of measuring something and then trying to impact like how that system changes to try and control a variable. And when I was researching Compound, they have this mechanism for setting interest rates. And I thought something that I didn't really like about it so much was there seemed to be quite a lot of tinkering with the interest rate models. Like for a given asset, what should the interest rate model be for that asset? It seemed to like require input from governance or sometimes, you know, centralized parties. And so I thought, can we do better than this? So I started experimenting with this idea that you could set interest rates using control theory. And so I built this toy model of this process, and again simulated it because I had these actors that were like selfish actors in the simulation, essentially just trying to get the best interest rate they could, and given their environment and the broader environment for interest rates and so on. So I built this toy model, and then I started talking to my co-founder and other people in this hackathon about this idea, and that's really for me how I got started. And for Doug, it was more, you know, building a kind of secure system. His background was network security. He was interested in like permissionless lending and really decentralizing systems. And the other problem with Compound was that they only supported a few assets. And anyway, we ended up smashing these ideas together, and that's how Euler was born, really, in the hackathon. Those two things came together. We thought they were quite complementary. And yeah, that's where it all got started.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Do you still have this toy model? I think it would be pretty cool if you publish it, you know, as the thing that started it all.
You know what I do? It was written in it's written in something that's really uncool called MATLAB, which I use.
Oh, yeah. I had to do that as well in university.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I don't think many people would be able to use it. Hey.
No, it's I used all these different sort of coding like applications, and that was one that like universities love it because MATLAB get paid a bunch of fees every year for these big subscriptions. And it's kind of useful for when you do a lot of math-based research. But yeah, for better or worse, it was written in MATLAB. I've still got some of the old. I think one of the things that wowed the judges when we submitted this hackathon was I made these GIFs of what an interest rate looks on compound, and it was very sort of volatile. And then I showed an interest rate, hypothetical interest rate from the simulation. That was more stable. And people were like, oh yeah, they could like literally see it. And it was like a few weeks work, to be honest, but it was impressive in the context of a hackathon. So yeah, that kind of helped it. So there's still some GIFs floating around somewhere with the original simulations on.
Yeah, I bet there's also some MATLAB to R or Python code as well. There should be some like easy way to translate, surely.
I'm sure.
But yeah, I feel like the graph that you showed was such a wow factor, because how often do you see that in a Web3 hackathon? Like, I would say probably never.
Yeah, I think it was a bit different because a lot of the people who do hackathons tend to, I guess, be coders, and they get started with, integrating into Web3, doing stuff, building on top of existing Web3 programs and stuff. So having a bit more of a mathematical element to it stood out, I think. Definitely, it was a bit different.
Yeah, so you did this in the hackathon, managed to win it, deploy the protocol, became really successful, and then after a while, big exploit happened.
Yeah, bad things happened.
How did that feel to, see so much hard work kind of go down the drain, even though you guys have plenty of audits, invested a lot in security, you still get hacked? How did that feel, and what was that experience like when it was happening?
I mean, it was it was devastating. I mean, it was really challenging because my son was born 4 days before the exploit. So he's still a new baby. I was about to go on paternity leave. The whole weekend I'd spent after he was born. So like he's born at very late on Thursday night, around midnight Thursday night. Then like midday through Friday, and things, rumors started circulating about the USDC solvency with the banking issues and so on. And so I spent a lot of the weekend. I apologized to my wife and said, look, there's this awful thing going on, but it could be really bad for the whole ecosystem, including all of it, if this thing really goes to zero or has further problems. So I spent a lot of the weekend doing that, and then woke up on Monday, late Sunday, there was news that it was kind of, that there'd been some kind of agreement with the government agency, some kind of bailout, I suppose. And it felt like, I was going to be able to start Monday, have a really enjoy paternity leave, a few weeks off, just me and my wife and son and daughter, just sort of getting to know each other. And 9 a.m. in the morning, my mum was round to take my daughter away, and my daughter was still in the house when it happened, and I just heard these alarms going off upstairs, and I thought it was, I just assumed, oh, there's some more news about these about this USDC issue, and went up, and it was people frantically messaging me from all over saying, yeah, Euler's being actively attacked right now. And it was harrowing, really, really harrowing experience, because I just remember everyone in the house was upset. Like, my daughter was upset, my mum was upset, they left, then my wife was just there, bless her, with the baby. Her sister had to come around and help. It was just like the first moments were, like, for us personally as a family, were horrific. And obviously everybody, all the victims in the protocol had lost, like, everything at that point. And they were feeling, beside themselves. The whole team was absolutely distraught. You know, we always took security really, really seriously. Like, we felt like we'd gone above and beyond in every dimension we could, and it was a real shock. Everybody who works in crypto and DeFi knows it's that this kind of stuff is possible. But Euler had been, not only had all these audits and everything, but it had been live for almost a year and a half, and there's a lot of assets in there. So it felt like we'd got over that period in which things tend to go wrong. And a lot of people thought that too, you know, that this was a secure protocol. It stood the test of time so far, and all the craziness of, like, the Luna collapse and FTX and all these other nasty events that led to huge volatility, and Euler stood firm in amongst all that. And it was a huge shock and really, really awful.
Was there any main takeaways from that bad experience?
So many. One of the most important things I think we learned about it was how resilient we were as a team at that time. We really came together really quickly and put our heads together. And I think, someone on our team said, when I held a team meeting and said, this looks really bad, obviously you guys be aware that this probably could be the end of Euler and your careers with us. So, and somebody immediately said, no, like, I'm not dropping this until we've caught the person. And that was the kind of spirit from right from the off. And that was huge in helping us get through that moment and ultimately recovering 100% of the funds and giving everyone their assets back and then having a chance to kind of start again. It was so learning that as a team, going through those tough moments, and there was no sort of, like, fallout or, like, any finger pointing or anything. We all just, like, really stood behind one another and worked as hard.
Yeah, that's really cool. That's the way it played out. But, you know, once a protocol gets hacked, the damage is done in a way, kind of like the public perception, it's already damaged. So how do you fix that? How do you bounce back from that kind of stuff when it happens? Do you just say sorry or bad? Because that doesn't look like, you know, it would cut it, even though the funds were recovered.
Yeah.
There's still, like, a bad taste in everyone's mouth.
I think so. Although I think it's a very forgiving industry, and I think everyone here realizes how tough it is and can see, like, when people are really trying and putting their all in. Like, no one is using DeFi today that doesn't realize that security is really challenging. It's a particularly challenging environment. And so the support we had was huge from the community generally, even affected users. A lot of the affected users were, like, other big protocols, like Angle and Balancer and Idol, people like that. And everyone was really, really supportive. Just wanted the best for us. The people that had invested in us were really supportive. The community at large, even people who lost money, sent messages of support. So I think overall that's really important to recognize. Yeah, it's just a very forgiving community at large, and the challenges that are faced are kind of widely known. But then beyond that, you just have to be kind of humble and show humility, accept that something went wrong, and then come back and be transparent and open about it and not try to hide from it. Like, one of the things, you know, someone said earlier on to us, well, why don't you just, like, rebrand and launch a new project? And I never wanted to do that. I thought, like, I didn't think we had anything to be ashamed of. Like, just every major lending protocol has had a critical vulnerability or multiple critical vulnerabilities in some cases discovered inside its code whilst in production. It's really hard to build one, and it's a very nascent industry where we're still, as a community, as a, like, developer community, learning about patterns that work well and like standards that things that you need to do. You know, it's evolving all the time, and so yeah, I just think ultimately it was about not hiding. We didn't have anything to hide. I think we came back and said, no, we're going to rebuild Euler V2 from scratch, and we'll go wherever we felt like we went the extra mile the first time around, but we're going to go the extra mile and learn as much as we can the second time around. But we have to be resilient and determined to get back out there.
Yeah, it sounds like you guys built a very good community, especially when we're talking about crypto communities, because I've seen a lot of communities out there that would get, super mad about something way less serious. So it sounds like you guys did a good job with the community. Do you have any sort of tips or wisdom on community building, like how you guys approach this part of the project,
Honestly, I've never really felt like we were good at community building in a sort of traditional sense. Like we've mainly just been a team of mostly developers or researchers, and none of us are particularly fond of social media or doing the traditional kind of, I don't know what people call community building or marketing. Like we're all really open and friendly people. Like if you come into our Discord, we'll always answer questions and always open to doing, podcasts like this and chatting to people really openly and transparently. But I don't think we're good at sort of maybe hyping up a community or doing all that kind of side. But I think part of the reason maybe why the community was supportive is we've always just tried to be kind of who we are and not try to pretend to be anything else. And we've been fairly honest about challenges. We always talk about trade-offs and both sides of things. If there's don't say something's secure or the best ever, you can try as hard as you can to make something secure, but no one can ever give you that guarantee. So just be honest and open.
For sure. And would you say that because no one in the team was kind of that marketing person, that was one of the challenges that you guys had when you're starting the protocol, or it just happened organically?
I think it's something that I found difficult as a founder is I found the research side and the technology side fairly easy, or it comes naturally, I suppose, to working as part of a team. It's in academia, I was worked in collaborative teams, and so we have that nature inside Euler. Anybody can challenge or be challenged. It's a very flat organization, not hierarchical as such. So that side kind of comes easy, but the side that's really hard, I think, for a first time founder is the distribution side and getting your message out there and learning how to communicate. One of the hard things I find is talking in too much of an academic way about things, which I'm used to doing a lot. I spent so long in that sort of field, and oftentimes you really need to do something on a sort of on a simpler level that resonates with just ordinary people who don't care about control theory and other weird nerdy math stuff. So yeah, that side's definitely been a bit more challenging for us generally.
And how did you manage to overcome that? How did you figure out distribution in your case?
Well, it's been a process, and I don't think we're not in our final form yet. I still think we've got stuff to learn. Getting advice, being open to advice and listening to people, constantly asking for feedback. I think it's really important to listen to people, and it's hard to know a little bit at the time, honestly, when you're a founder, because the people around you that you get given an awful lot of feedback constantly. So it's about kind of cycling through things and figuring out what's noise and what's signal in amongst all that feedback. But definitely helps to constantly listen and experiment and try to adapt. So we've tried to do that. And then you have to recognize what your own weaknesses are and bring on board people that are different from yourself, that have different backgrounds. And so Yeah, we've hired some fabulous people that have been, you know, really helpful with that. I mean, one person that's just come back to join the team who left a little while back is Alicia Katz. She's a sort of head of marketing person, and very, very different background from me, but we get along really well, and she just brings a whole different energy and different sort of vision for the project that developers don't tend to have. So
yeah, that makes sense. Was there a turning point when you guys realized that you kind of started to figure out a way to tackle this issue?
No, I don't. I mean, it's it's just been. I think it's really hard in crypto generally. How much do you need to focus on distribution versus the actual product? I mean, it's not just crypto, right? It's like the constant. It's a big debate among people who like to talk about, like, you know, how you should be as a founder. All these like people at A16Z are like the theory of being a founder. You know, is it product versus distribution? What percentage should you allocate of your time to those two different sort of sides of things? And I think it's different for every project and every industry. It varies massively. Arguably, in crypto, one of the most important things you can do is just survive, like just prove that you won't break. And it's that sort of anti-fragility that you need. And that in itself speaks volumes and will do the kind of marketing for you. And so in that sense, like it's really a focus on product that brings that credibility and that long-term success. Whereas, you can also go the other route and just go for the meme coin hype sort of thing and get instant sort of hype and success that way. But then how long is it going to have longevity and stick around? In some cases, if you're lucky, you can kind of build the product after and it falls into place. But oftentimes it doesn't in crypto. It will just die quite quickly. So I think we definitely focus more on the product still. We recognize that, you know, getting the message out is important, but it's if you have a really, really good product, I'm a firm believer that it will stand the test of time. And if you don't sort of rush for you know, getting $1 billion TVL overnight and focus on long-term goals, you'll have more success that way.
Yeah, and I feel like the big container contest that's going on right now is probably a great way to do both, right? Because that surely helps in distribution to some extent, and that goes hand in hand with building something that's going to stand the test of time.
Yeah.
And because it is such a big contest, how do you prepare for that? Because there's going to be way more people participating and the stakes are a lot higher. There's going to be a lot more volume. So what does the lead up to that look like?
Well, we've been preparing for it over a year. I mean, really, Euler V2, the design for that started even before the exploit. Things like Euler V2 is not really a product of what happened with the exploit. The reason that we're building Euler V2 the way we are now in this more modular fashion is because of other issues I had with the general, or the other learnings that we had from like V1, the way it worked and things that it was good at, things that it was bad at, and so on. So we wanted to build a more modular product for other reasons, and those reasons partly were enhanced security as well. Going back to the very basics, just building in a modular fashion helps prepare you for a contest like this, because you build these components that they can be readily tested in place. They do a few things and they do them really well and nothing else, and then the idea is you compose them together later. And obviously that composability brings its own risks, but I think, having the modular stack has definitely helped prepare us. So you'll see, with the contest, we've got these different components as part of Euler V2. We've got this thing called the Euler Vault Kit. So that's one big module or component. We've got the Euler pricing oracles and the pricing mechanisms. That's another big thing. And then we have these vaults where people deposit assets, and those vaults can be connected to one another into networks into their own lending protocols. And so you need a connector protocol for that. And so we have this other connection system called the Ethereum Vault Connector. We've been building those three things in-house for a long time. Robust testing We hired a head of cybersecurity to help manage the teams and make sure that all the processes were, being carried out internally first and foremost. We invited people from, top security researchers from Spearbit and other places, other lending protocols, to come and audit our processes in-house long before we even got to audit. That was a crucial thing. Then, of course, audits themselves. Having formal verification, we brought Satora in-house to help work on the formal verification stuff. They've been a great help. We've got an invariant testing suite for fuzz testing and so on. So that's helped a lot. And then just documentation and constant feedback. We have multiple teams inside Euler. So we actually have two different smart contract teams. We had one team coming in and auditing internally the work of the other teams and figuring out where the holes were, right? Because as you're writing the documentation, it's very easy to kind of get too much in the weeds of things and miss bits that are not obvious to other people. So it's been useful having the other team come in and say, no, this wasn't clear to me when trying to run things or trying to read the white paper and so on. It's been an awful long process. And the other thing I think is just to take your time and not worry about, what the market's doing or what other competitors are doing. You're like running your own race and you're only going to win it if you, if you do it at a sustainable pace that is, that enables you to catch bugs and not worry, about just chucking in a load of features. You really deeply research every single component that goes into the system, and having the time and space to do that's been important.
So sounds like you guys been preparing for a long, long time for this.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that you don't really look at the competition, you just try to do the best you can. But I guess in a sense, you kind of have to look at the competition to make sure, you're being competitive to whatever it's out there. And right now, I would say Euler V2's biggest competitor would be Morpho. Mm-hmm. And they're very similar in a lot of ways. They're both modular lending protocols, but they are kind of different in a lot of ways as well. And I'd like to talk a little bit about their differences, how they're similar, how they're different. Yeah. In my head, I think a silly way to make an analogy to this is kind of like Apple versus Windows a little bit. Mm-hmm. So what would you say are the biggest similarities and the biggest differences between Euler and Morpho?
Let's start with the similarities. I think we both converged, both teams converged on a similar idea, I think, a while back, part of the reason for building Euler V2. The thing that we recognized, I think both recognized, was that some of the dominant players in the market, like Aave, have this very, what I would call like a monolithic design, where all the assets sit inside this one big, large protocol, and that large protocol is governed by a DAO. And that presents a number of challenges. It means that ultimately you have just one risk-reward output for everybody, and either you like that, either Aave is risky enough for you and provides a nice yield, or it doesn't. It's for some people it won't be taking enough risk and providing enough yield. For other people, it's taking too much, and so it doesn't provide that like flexibility and that free market that people desire. The other thing is that governance as a whole, I think, of risk and risk management should be carried out by specialists. And DAOs as a whole aren't really specialists. So you don't necessarily want individuals who have vested interests in things trying to directly govern risk parameters in a lending protocol. Building a secure lending protocol in an environment that's very, very dynamic is really challenging, and managing risk in an environment is really, really hard. And no one should underestimate how hard that is, and it shouldn't be left up to just individual token holders. So in the end, you end up appointing, risk managers, but then the risk manager has all the control, and you have this very, suddenly control of this massive system, and it's not decentralized anymore. So what's the DAO doing there, really? So the idea behind the Euler and Morpho shared ideal, I think, was to externalize risk management and to really make the protocol itself really a piece of technology that anybody can build on top of, and they can bring their own ideas, externalize the risk management to third parties, and have more localized governance over key parts of the system rather than just one big governor of the entire monolith. Just have more of a localized governance process over a smaller number of assets or just a particular asset class or type of trade and so on. And then have those risk managers compete with one another so that users can then assess them and find a risk manager that's right for them. So that's one of our key areas of similarity. I call this paternalistic governance, which I think is like a DAO-led governance model versus more like localized or free market governance. Morpho and Euler both have a base layer. And on a base layer, we have essentially these vaults where people deposit assets and they lend them to others. And those on the base layer, the general philosophy is that there is no governor, that you can create lending markets that anybody can come into and leave as they want to at any point in time. And there's really like a fixed level of risk for each component of this base layer. So the idea is that somebody won't be changing the parameters for you. There's no paternalistic element here where someone's holding your hand. So at the base layer, it's up to you really to manage your own risk. If the environment changes, the risk is too high, then you should leave one pool and go into a less risky pool. And then I guess that's not right for everybody, right? Not everybody's set up to be able to constantly adapt and manage their own risk. And so the idea, rather than having a monolith on top, is to have like more localized risk managers that you deploy into first, and then the risk manager kind of manages those assets and puts them directly, then modifies flows into the lower level base vaults into pools with riskier or less risky parameters, depending on how the economic conditions change.
So you'd say that Euler and Morpho kind of work in the same way, as they have this base layer that allows people to sign up to different kinds of risk management approaches. And what would you say is the biggest difference between them?
It really comes down to, one way to put this is that you can build Morpho and its vault system on Euler, but you can't build Euler on Morpho. Morpho is a simpler system by design that puts simplicity as one of its key design goals, which is good in many ways. It targets it's very opinionated in its lower level design structure, and it targets a specific type of user. Euler, on the other hand, aims for a less opinionated setup and more flexibility. And with more flexibility, we argue, comes more capital efficiency. And capital efficiency, liquidity generally flows to more capital efficient solutions over time. Part of the problem with the Morpho system is that on the base layer, you have just a lending vault and then a single collateral attached to that vault. So you just have pairs. So you have someone lending USDC and someone using ETH as collateral, for example. And then you might have many instances of that same setup where each of those pairs has different loan to value parameters dictating how much people can borrow. The problem with that is that for borrowers, it's quite a painful experience. You have many of these pairs, and as lenders come and go and leave the pairs, the borrowers themselves have to kind of follow those flows as well, have to constantly adapt their processes, which means that it's kind of challenging environment for borrowers. On Euler, the things are very different. Where you have a lending vault, and then rather than have a single collateral be able to borrow from that vault, that you can have any number of collaterals be able to access that vault. And furthermore, those collaterals themselves can be other lending vaults. And that's essentially how Aave works as well. On Aave, if you have USDC, you can borrow USDT using USDC and vice versa. So you have what's called rehypothecation. Really what that means is, rather than accepting USDC as collateral, you're actually accepting Aave USDC as collateral, or you're accepting Aave USDT. And so with rehypothecation like that comes extra risk, but also extra reward. It's a more capital efficient system. It means for borrowers that when they deposit their collateral, they might earn a yield on that collateral at the same time that they're paying a cost to borrow something. And so for the borrowers, it becomes much cheaper to borrow in a system with rehypothecation generally than it does in one without rehypothecation. So at the base layer, Morpho lacks that key attribute, and it only allows a single collateral to borrow from a single vault. Whereas Euler allows multiple collaterals to borrow from a vault and allows each of those collaterals themselves to be lending vaults. So yeah, it's more complex setup, which comes with trade-offs, but on the upside, that brings essentially more capital efficiency to the system.
What would you say those trade-offs would be?
I've already mentioned like the challenge with rehypothecation is that ultimately if you hold some collateral in escrow, if you ever need to liquidate that position, you know that the collateral is always going to be there because it's not being lent out. It's always ready to access. The challenge with rehypothecation ultimately is there's increased risk because in the event that you want to liquidate a position, there's no guarantee that the underlying asset is there. It could be being temporarily borrowed by somebody, or it could be just generally inaccessible, which means that as a whole, lenders need to be more careful potentially if they're lending to people that are using rehypothecated collateral than just escrowed kind of held in place collateral. Now, ultimately for the lenders, the flip side there is that, if they have more borrowers, because borrowers can rehypothecate, then they'll earn more yield too, right? So for the lenders, they essentially open up they have more customers, as it were, if they accept more diverse collateral types and have rehypothecation, but they expose themselves to more risk. But if you restrict things, then yeah, less risk, less reward. There's never a free lunch in finance, right? And so it's always a lie to say something's like risk-free reward. I think it never really plays out like that. But I think in general, you can still manage the risks of rehypothecation. And a lot of people like that model. Like it's been very, very successful for Aave, for instance, which has this model of rehypothecation inbuilt to it. And it generally just makes things less fragmented and makes life easier for borrowers and lenders alike. They don't need to be constantly rebalancing. So it's not just the capital efficiency, but it's also just like practical efficiency of the system. I think it's higher. And the key thing on Euler is that it's ultimately optional. If you say, no, I don't want rehypothecated collateral. I only want to lend my USDC to one collateral type. Then you can still build that. It's a very flexible, modular kit. You can still build the simple version if you like. But if you want to innovate and have more efficiency, you can build that in as well. It's really up to the free market to determine in the long run what succeeds, what wins.
And you said that with this flexibility, someone could literally build Morpho on Euler, and people can argue that could make Morpho absolute or just very easily forkable. So how easy would that be?
I mean, it'd be very, very easy to build Morpho on Euler for sure. I think that's just one model that could work well. They would probably argue that there are other differences. I mean, one of the benefits that they argue for their system is ultimately that by neglecting all these other features, they can make their simpler smart contracts, which creates in principle a smaller attack surface. And I think that's a fair argument. But beyond that, yeah, I think you could quite easily recreate Morpho on Euler, and you could also recreate all the way up. You can recreate something like RVV3 very easily on Euler as well. And ultimately that choice gets put in the hands of the vault creators. And those vault creators are rewarded for the choices they make as well. Euler shares, by default, it shares its fees with the people who create vaults. And so you're free to go and build something like Morpho or like Aave or somewhere in between, or something that's like some kind of weird, you know, two-headed monster, if you like. And if it's successful and the market rewards you with liquidity, then you'll ultimately be rewarded with fees. And so that's another way that Euler differs with respect to helping foster growth and drive network effects. The thing about Euler is it's very extensible as well. When you have when somebody builds a successful USDC vault on Euler, anybody else can come along and build another vault that accepts that USDC vault as collateral. So if you're first to market and you deploy the first very successful USDC vault, it's very likely that people building on top of you in the future are going to want to accept your vault as collateral because it has it's ready-made liquidity for their new vault. And so with Euler, it'll help solve this kind of cold start problem that lending protocols have a lot. Obviously, Euler itself needs to get going first, but once innovation comes and once the network starts to grow, you have these very, very powerful network effects where, yeah, existing liquidity gets accepted more and more as collateral for other vaults, which gives it more utility, which leads to more deposits, which leads to more utility and so on. You get very strong positive feedback loops and network growth effects.
Do you already have people building on Euler, like projects that, you know, are ready to be deployed or are, you know, on the last steps, and as soon as you guys launch, there's going to be some projects on top of it already?
I expect so, yeah. I mean, it's hard to know what other people's timelines are, but there's lots of people that have been reaching out asking how they can build custom solutions. The Euler vaults are not just flexible in the ways I've already talked about, but they'll have all these other features, and we get asked a lot of questions about, like, can we add like compliance checks? Can we add like a security oracle? Can we do stuff with hooks? Can we have like delay withdrawal delays? We have all these people asking really questions about like innovating in the lending space. And so I can't say for sure where they all are in their development like timeline, but there's for sure we're going to see, you know, over the months that follow, I think quite a lot of new and interesting ideas like play out in the Euler ecosystem.
From what we just kind of discussed, my takeaway is that Euler's biggest problem is probably its complexity, which is kind of like what you the trade-off from flexibility. Would you agree with that? That it's probably way more complex to build something or integrate something Euler than it would be with Morpho? But on the other hand, you get to do whatever you want basically on Euler, which wouldn't be the case on Morpho or other protocols.
I think the complexity is somewhat of a challenge, although it's like complexity, you can't run away from complexity. It always emerges one way or another, right? It emerges when people start to like compose Aave with Uniswap, and then like, you know, people, you've got like stable coins on Aave being like swapped and like leverage positions. So the complexity emerges because ultimately there's a desire for complexity. There's a desire for functionality, and you can't run away from that. And so the key thing, going back to your question about, you know, Windows versus Apple and so on, is, you know, how do you build it in? How do you enable it? Our philosophy is always that, firstly, you start with modularity so that you have composability at every level of the stack, and then you can test things, make sure that they work in a robust manner in and of themselves. But then it's useful to have this complexity built by the same set of developers with the same like big broader vision of how things work. Because if you just focus on narrow like use cases, you often miss that there's like easy wins and there's ways to compose things that if you just added, you know, if you just built things ever so slightly differently, that you would actually make things more composable. So I think we see this a lot with the, you know, with like the way that people trade and leverage using lending protocols and DEXs in combination today. Like it works, and like composability and the like money Lego things is something to be celebrated, but it's also still quite clunky and like deeply inefficient in many ways. There are multiple like fees that get taken along the way. You know, you end up using like a DEX aggregator and then using like a DeFi saver, and you like our Sumify, and then like Aave itself, and Uniswap fees, and then front end fees and hook fees. Like, there's a lot going on still, and there's a lot of complexity there, and it's I'd say like it's slightly chaotic almost. Like, it's not being built in a cohesive way with the end user in mind, who's using all those things in combination. And that's one of the advantages I think we have from building Euler V1 to now, is we got to see that full user journey and see all the things that people were doing and the things they really liked. And so that we can now build back a modular stack that enables all those things to be performed in a really like cohesive way and in an efficient manner. And so that's how we've dealt with the complexity. We sort of acknowledge it and try to accommodate it, accommodate what people want.
Yeah, it makes sense. Did you guys already have the hook implementation idea way back then, or was that something that you got inspired by the Uniswap? How did that concept emerge for you guys?
I think the hook thing is kind of like good marketing from Uniswap, because like hooks and callbacks are like a very common pattern in programming, especially like asynchronous, like dealing with like asynchronous stuff on the web. People use these hooks and callbacks all the time, right? So it's not really anything novel from a like fundamental standpoint of a coder. Were we inspired by Uniswap? I actually don't know, to be honest. I think one thing that wasn't really Uniswap inspired was always this acknowledgement that there was going to be growth in like what I would call on-chain finance rather than decentralized finance. And on-chain finance wants things that decentralized finance doesn't want. Like, on-chain finance, people want to institute like checks and balances that like wouldn't necessarily be acceptable to like people who want fully permissionless, like ready to go soft systems, like withdrawal delays, for instance, on deposits. Like, that breaks composability of DeFi protocols, and it's a very common pattern in TradFi, right? Like, you go to your bank, you ask to get $100, you're probably fine. But if you ask for $100,000, they're gonna delay that, right? They're gonna ask for some more information and so on. So having extra use cases and having like extra sort of checks and balances and things makes sense. Like, in some cases, people want to work with these zero knowledge proof providers of KYC and so on. So they want to go off and be able to check in a secure but like private manner that somebody meets some criteria for a particular jurisdiction, for instance. It was always clear to us that was coming. And hooks enable you to build that. So if you want to build Euler vaults with certain like constraints, you can add these things in a very like modular and flexible way. And there are official people who are building that kind of thing already using the Euler Vault kit. Another interesting thing, I think, is the security stuff. There's ways to implement security checks and balances at the point at which people enter and exit DeFi protocols by working with other partners, right? There are other security providers out there like Hypernative and others who can add in checks and balances that can prevent actions from being taken inside vaults and so on in certain circumstances. And obviously this, you have to sacrifice some decentralization and place some trust in these providers, but there are a large number of users that want that. There are obviously a large number of users that don't want that, and that's fine in my opinion. It's a free market. Let the free market rule supreme and figure out what people want. But yeah, for those that do want it, I think having hooks enabling people to institute these extra checks and balances can be really useful.
Yeah, it seems like modularity has been penetrating every layer of the blockchain stack, from the blockchain stack itself to the application layer. And sometimes I wonder if that's like a phase that we're going through right now, where modularity is kind of like the meta and is the way to go. And then as the industry kind of matures and gets more ossified, the use cases become more transparent, and you can tell which are the categories that drive the main use bases. Do you think that we might shift back to more monolithic or maybe even more paternalistic, like you mentioned, sort of protocols? Or do you think modularity is kind of like the OG here to stay pattern that is just fundamentally better and allows for the free hand to do its thing?
I think in the end, people like products. Users want products. They couldn't care less like how the internet works under the hood, but they like the products that the internet delivers to them. And those products are often really like tailored to specific users. They don't last a long time, you know. iPods and things, like, they come and go, right? But they like serve a purpose, that they really like service a need at a particular point in time. And I think products will always rule supreme at the application level. But what are products? Well, if it's Uniswap, it's someone who's building a product is really someone who's building a really cool hook that does something that liquidity providers or swappers really like and value. And it's likely that they're going to face competition from people building similarly cool hooks. And then you'll have like very intense competition at that like product layer, application layer. And it probably flows around, and it's maybe not that decentralized, to be honest. Like, it's probably, I think that's the thing with these very product specific protocols, is they end up not being very decentralized because they have to be adaptable. Whereas if you look at the like lower down the stack, like the internet is fundamentally modular, and it works that way because it's because of all the properties modularity we discussed that are beneficial, right? Like the ability to test components, to keep them simple, to make them like essentially be something that can be kind of open source and free as a public good, like that other people can build on. It's you don't often want to build on things that other people are like trying to extract value from, and that's fine to extract value from users of products, but it's not necessarily fine to extract value from users of the developer like set on the like base layer or the architecture. So I think we'll see modularity prosper in for architectural things, and we'll see more product specific things prosper at the application layer. And I think Euler does is it focuses on modularity at the architecture layer. Like the Vault kit is very modular. It's a module in and of itself, but if you break it into pieces, it's also got submodules and submodules of submodules and so on. So it's very composable in that regard. And then the communications layer for the Vault kit is extremely sort of primitive. It doesn't charge anybody a fee. It's fully open source. Anybody can build on the Ethereum Vault connector. So I think all that modularity really benefits base layer architectural projects. And that's really what Euler is aiming to be. It's not aiming to be products. We're building something that other people can build products on top of.
Yeah, that makes sense. And when you're reasoning about, you know, what V2 should look like from all the takeaways you got from V1, how do you map and understand how, like, where the gaps are and how you could fill these gaps?
In the sense of, like, what were the limitations of V1?
More in the sense of, like, actually looking at the space and reasoning about it, and, like, iterating in your head, like, okay, this is what we should do and this is why we should do it.
Yeah, I think the big thing that I think I observed was I just felt like governance was kind of failing in lending, and that there was a opportunity there to have lending systems that were free from governance, from DAOs. As a whole, I think that I really liked the DAO ideal when it first emerged. I thought that Compound, especially, it was creating this kind of gold standard for how a DAO should work. And then I think it's important to kind of continuously reevaluate things and look at how they're performing. And if you just looked at even major DAOs, we were seeing like governance proposals for impacting hundreds of millions of dollars being passed with like fewer than 10 voters. And that's like just crazy to me that it's just fewer than 10 voters. And people make excuses. They say, oh yeah, no, it's just because everyone's like optimistically, they're behaving optimistically, right? They only vote if they don't like something. But I just don't really buy that. It just seemed like there's that ultimately people don't like voting or like aren't prepared to vote and that they're not qualified to vote, and that DAOs, you know, implementing changes worth serious amounts of money like this is just not a good idea and destined for kind of trouble in the long run. So I kind of recognize that as a key challenge that needed addressing, that it wasn't DAO governance of risk management doesn't scale very well. Beyond that, it was the other thing was that there just wasn't this ability to service diverse risk reward demands. You know, you and I probably have very different like risk thresholds, tolerances for things like how much we're prepared to sort of speculate. Like, is 10% yield enough for you? Like, is it too risky? You know, well, it's just there's so many diverse preferences out there, and the idea that, you know, that basically there's just Aave and that's all there'll ever be, and that's going to be the like bedrock of like the future of finance on chain. It's crazy. Like, that isn't the way the real world works. Like, it's a massive world out there and people have different needs and so on. And so, yeah, perhaps DeFi was small yesterday and it was fine to just have one place where you could go get one interest rate for the asset and be subject to the risk of that protocol. But the reality is that if DeFi is going to scale, that it's going to need to have a lot of different diverse opportunities for people, some very conservative, some very high on the risk end of the spectrum. And that need wasn't really being met. There'd been a few attempts to meet it with things like Rari Fuse and so on. But like, I think, a really like serious stab at it hadn't really been taken, at least when we first started developing Euler V2. I think that's changed a lot and there are lots of cool designs out there, and that sort of like need has been addressed in a multitude of ways now, like with Ashner and other things. So it's kind of cool. It's very the space of lending is like very multi-dimensional and there's not one size fits all ever, so you are going to see lots of different types of lending protocols flourish over time, I think, each satisfying a different niche.
Yeah, I agree. I think especially as more people come on chain, people are going to want things that fit their profile. And with that in mind, what would you say is the next iteration of Euler? I know you guys are just about to launch V2, so probably that's very far away, but do you already have kind of like a list of features you want to see for V3? Maybe you see what's already missing in this current lending meta. So how does V3 look like in your head at the moment?
You know what? The nice thing about V2 is that in a way there doesn't really ever need to be a V3. And that's because you can design new vaults with new capabilities and add them onto the system. And they can interact with the old vaults if they like or not. And that's quite unusual for a lending protocol. You know, if you kind of build Aave before, it's unlikely that it's going to be able to tap in directly or work very well with Aave V3. Similar with Compound V3 and V2, right? Like, they're very disconnected kind of iterations, whereas that won't be the case. So yeah, I won't say that innovation stops with all of V2 and that like we're done, like we just go sort of sit on our hands for a few years now. I think there's still loads to do, but I think it will be iterating on top of V2. I might be wrong, but I think we designed the kind of core primitive at the heart of V2, this EVC, Ethereum Vault Connector thing, is really what pieces everything together. So long as we still think that vaults are a useful way to wrap up assets and then have them lend and borrow, you know, from one another, connect. So long as we have a need for vaults to be able to act as collateral from one another so that you can have lending and borrowing between vaults, I think the EVC will be around for a very long time, and that will provide that sort of foundational level architecture, which we can innovate. On specific things that I think would be cool to see, I think I've already mentioned like real world assets using hooks, bringing more real world assets on chain. Right now, the real world asset space is a little bit boring because people are just keep tokenizing real world assets. And I think that's not really, that by itself is, it's kind of dry. Like grandmas and granddads and like boomers like to like, you know, buy bonds and then they just sit on them and they do nothing with them. But like what's exciting about, if there's anything exciting about TradFi, it's like where people trade, right? People want to be able to trade 24/7 and they want to be able to hedge and take risk and so on. And they want to be able to trade between different types of bonds. They want to trade Forex and so on. And for that trading, you need robust infrastructure that enables that trading. And today we don't really have it because you can create lending markets for real world assets, but creating lending markets that allow people to then interact with a DEX and then kind of loop back and create these leverage positions and so on doesn't really exist very well today. And I think that's going to change massively in the next six to 12 months. You're going to see more assets tokenized than ever before, and suddenly a flood of people wanting to trade those assets on chain 24/7, cross border, very low cost, in super efficient markets. I think that's going to be massive. What other things? I still think there's a whole like lot of innovation that can be done with integrating between DEXs and lending protocols. It's no secret that we've been thinking about the DEX design space and how it interacts with lending for quite a while. I think there's some cool stuff you can do that we've been researching, linking LP tokens in DEXs to lending markets and being able to lend and borrow LP tokens. That's something that was kind of tried in the early days of Uni V2, but never really found much success. And one of the reasons it didn't find success actually is going back to a point I made earlier about like when you have two separate teams building things, they often don't necessarily know what each other's thinking. And in the case of Uniswap, it was that they didn't really anticipate that LP tokens would be something you might want to lend or borrow. And so the kind of checks and balances that you need to build into an LP token if you want that just weren't present. And that made pricing LP tokens very, very difficult. And it ended up just not being something people did. But I think we'd like to revisit that idea and see if we can actually bring about better harmony between DEXs and lending protocols.
What would you say is the most popular interaction between lending and DEXs, like in terms of like users?
Right now, there's the market is really geared towards building leverage positions. I think like it's the main reason Maker exists is because people like to go long ETH. And what people do is they essentially borrow a dollar, which in the case of Maker is a synthetic dollar. And then they will swap it on a lending protocol for more ETH and then redeposit the ETH as collateral and then borrow more dollars, swap it for more ETH, and they keep doing this process as many times as they can, and they kind of loop the system, and that gives them leverage. It gives you leverage on spot markets as well. Like a lot of people on centralized exchanges, a lot of leverage is typically built using like artificial forms of leverage. They end up using like perpetual futures or other systems that just don't really interact with the underlying spot markets. So then you're not really margin trading, you're just trading kind of made up assets. And I think what people like about doing trading on chain is that you're actually interacting with the underlying like spot, you know, exchanges. You know, when you actually go leverage long, you're actually depleting ETH from the spot markets and in some sense driving the price up. So you're actually supporting your own trade. When you do that on perpetual futures, you can often be doing the exact opposite. You can actually be providing the fuel for kind of the opposite to happen and price to go down. So it's just much nicer for people to trade leverage positions on chain using over collateralized lending protocols than it is elsewhere. And I think that's one of the big use cases. But as I said before, it's still an imperfect trading environment because it's still often more expensive to trade in that way on chain today than it is to trade on perpetuals futures exchanges. And so they're still preferred largely. But I think that may change in the future with key innovations in the way that DEXs and lending protocols integrate with one another. I think you can bring things much closer in line with the margin trading on chain and like perpetual futures off chain.
Do you think a hook could double as a Uniswap hook and an RLV2 hook, and that could sort of facilitate this and make it a lot cheaper, maybe even akin to perpetuals?
Possibly. I mean, I think one of the key things you need to do is solve the fee problem. Like the issue with building leverage on chain comes back again to the idea that the two things were kind of built in isolation, and they're not designed to support the overall trade that you want is a leverage trade, right? But like what the lending protocol and the DEX are designed to do is support the components of that trade. And wouldn't it be nice if rather than paying a fee on every single step of the journey, you could just pay like one discounted fee at the end? You know, like if you buy something at the supermarket, you get 10 things, it's often cheaper than if you just buy one thing. But if you're doing that trade where you like lever up and you like loop around 10 times, shouldn't it be cheaper than if you just loop once? You know, there's maybe like arguments like that could be made, and yeah, maybe things like hooks and other like changes to the way the systems work could enable you to build more efficient systems for leverage trading.
Awesome. Michael, thank you so much for coming by. I feel like this hour flew by and there's so much more we can talk about, but I don't want to hold you much longer, but I had a blast. I'm really keen to see the result of the Arler contest and really keen to see what people build on top of it. Maybe I'll ask one last question.
Yeah.
What is the thing you're most excited to see being built on Arler?
Good question. I'm really excited to see, out of all the things, I think it's something that we've been thinking a lot about, which is new types of synthetic assets, I think, and allowing them to integrate with the lending protocol and allowing them in the future to integrate with an Euler DEX of some form. I think there's this kind of idea of like a holy trinity, right, of having a DEX, a lending protocol, and a stable coin, and it's not been achieved by many teams. Curve is there today. I think you've got Frax as well, but not many teams have achieved this. But like having the three work together, they can help support one another and drive growth and network effects and benefits. I think that's really cool. And so synthetics are kind of key to that, in my opinion. And that's one thing that I'm really excited to talk more about in the future.
Do you think Athena has a horse in this race as well?
Yeah, I mean, like the growth of Athena has been just outrageous. I mean, it's just been an overnight success. Who knew, right? I think everyone knew that there was this trade that you could do where you could, you know, take the opposite side of the trade for people going long on perpetual futures and earn funding from that, and then you can kind of you can kind of hedge that, you know, in other ways. That's definitely something that like a lot of people have been done for a long time. But the idea that you could then tokenize that and like bring it to the masses, I think has been this huge success. So for sure they're like a massive player in the market now. There's no denying that. But ultimately, there's ways to innovate, and I think synthetics still have their own advantages, and I think in the long run there might be interesting opportunities for competition with things like Athena that exist purely on chain rather than having this off chain component as well.
Awesome. All right, man, thank you so much, and keen to see what happens.
Yeah, me too. It's whatever happens, it will be interesting for sure. Fingers crossed, it all goes well.